Good morning, everyone. We'd like to welcome everyone to the Mesa City Council study session for January the 11th. The first item on our agenda today is to hear a presentation and provide direction on a proposed decorative tree lighting policy. Gentlemen, good to have you with us. We're looking forward to hearing more about this topic.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning, members of the council. My name is RJ Zeter with the Transportation Department. With me this morning is Eric Guderian, Deputy Director for Engineering, and Gordon Hawes, Deputy Director for Field Operations. So we have several policies or proposed policies that we would like to discuss with you briefly. Please feel free to answer questions or ask questions as we're moving along, and we'll jump right in. The first staff was asked to develop a policy regarding decorative tree lighting. So there's some shots of what decorative tree lighting is. The large picture on the left of the screen is the Hilton down on Holmes that a few years back the city worked to light some palm trees to sort of define the entry to that facility. If you look at the map, in addition to the Hilton, most recently, just before Christmas, working with our engineering department, we installed decorative lighting adjacent to the main entrance to Evett on Main Street. So if you were to drive down there in the evening, you'll see that those trees are lit and do a very nice job of framing the entrance into their facility. Evaluation criteria, Mr. Hawes and his staff worked to develop the proposed criteria. What came out of the discussion at the Sustainability and Transportation Committee of Council that talked about all three of the policies that we've got up for discussion this morning is at the end of the conversation, the committee proposed or recommended that the city only pay for lighting entries on public property or in front of public entities. Also, we would look, and you can see it more in the council report, there would have to be some demonstration that there will be a benefit to the city as a whole in adding the decorative lighting. But this policy is not meant to offset any normal lighting requirements that would come with any property in the city. In addition, the lit trees would have to be located either within existing right-of-ways or easements, or the property owner adjacent would have to dedicate that property to the city so that we could install the lights. Responsibilities, again, the city would be responsible for design, construction, and getting power to the lights. Post-construction, we would really turn it over to the adjacent property owner, and they would be responsible for everything down the road, including any repair costs, utility costs, or additions to the lighting. So staff is seeking council approval of this policy, proposed policy, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thompson.
I still struggle with the city of Mesa paying for lighting or paying the construction fees and the electrical, the cost to run the electric and everything for other governmental agencies. When you look at the other governmental agencies across Mesa, there are quite a few, whether it's Roosevelt Water Conservation District or SRP even for that matter, since they're quasi-governmental, any school, any county facility. It just seems like there's a lot that all of a sudden any agency within the city of Mesa, any governmental agency within the city of Mesa could come in and say, hey, I want decorative lighting. It's a benefit to Mesa. How do we thwart off future of having just everybody come knock on the city's door and say, run the electric, do the design, because I want decorative lighting on my trees?
Thank you, council member. That's a great question. One of the review criteria would be to bring any requests through the budget process. So that's one way that council would have the opportunity to weigh in as to whether you see as a group a value in the request. There is a challenge. Obviously, you're correct. There's a lot of public entities. One option, the committee, I think, discussed this, is not to do any more, decorative lighting, at city expense. This is clearly a policy question for you and the members of the council. I believe, and you were at the SAT meeting, obviously, I believe that the focus was try to narrow the scope in not doing any further lighting installations for private properties, and we've limited it to public. But as you stated, there still are a lot of public properties, you know, in the city. So the way it's structured right now, if it were approved as is, it would go through the budget process. But an option is to no longer pay for any installations going forward.
Mr. Glover.
RJ, what did these two projects cost from the city's perspective?
Do you recall the number was over? Go ahead, Gordon.
Councilmember, the Hilton project was approximately $80,000, and the one at EVIT was approximately $108,000.
Okay. Mr. Freeman.
Other than those two requests that you've already done, are there any other entities out there that request decorative lighting?
Councilmember, I'm not aware of any entities other than the two that have made requests.
So these are ones that we've just done over the years, and we've just done it out of our goodwill?
Yes.
Okay.
We've done it at the request of council.
From whom?
A council member.
Council members.
Okay.
So there's no pending requests from other governmental agencies or private property owners?
That's correct, Mayor.
Yeah. Well, and if that's the case, do we need a policy, or should we continue to do it just on a one-off basis? And if there's a particular project that we go, wow, that's a good idea, we do it. If not, then we...
So this came up in the budget discussion, so we're back here today because we'd had that request and we were having to make a decision in the budget whether to allocate the dollars. If the policy of the council is to say no more, and then, you know, and if there's a request, obviously it's going to be a one-off regardless, just because they'll be coming to all of us and trying to persuade us to do it. This actually opens a door we haven't had opened before, where we actually say that we would consider doing it for governmental or public agencies. I mean, that's new. We've actually never even had a policy about this. It's always had to be considered one-on-one. And I think, I don't know, I don't know that we think two means that there's going to be a lot more. It's hard to judge what's going to happen in the future, I guess. That's our little bit of our dilemma. We could just go back and say it's just not something we actually plan on and we don't anticipate it, and our policy wouldn't necessarily be to do it, and then just take them one at a time. But I think during the budget, we thought, when we had a discussion before, we kind of said maybe we ought to come up with a policy, but maybe after going through it, maybe we should pass. I don't know. But that's why we're back here.
There's one point that I want to bring up from the SAC committee meeting that we had, and that's that I think in the past instance we did it on the Hilton, which was private-owned property, versus working with other intergovernmental, like the EVIT project that we did. So from my perspective, I think it's important that we set the standard that we're not going to pay for the decorations for private-owned entities. So at a minimum, I would say we need something that reflects that policy from the SAT meeting.
Okay. My experience is that, and I think, I imagine this is a shared experience, when I go to conventions, meetings of U.S. Conference of Mayors and Leagues of Cities and Towns at the state and local level, the room is always full of people from lighting companies talking about how cool it is to light buildings. Here's all the different colors and logos, and this is kind of a hip topic nowadays, is lighting, you know, lighting bridges, lighting pink lights for this holiday, and I think it's good. It's attractive, and it's I don't want to exclude Mesa from being involved in technology and lighting and making our downtown and other commercial areas more attractive. So I don't know that we need a policy discouraging lighting, additional lighting, particularly at the entrances, making a more dramatic entrance to facilities and neighborhoods and buildings. But I agree with Mr. Whitaker. I don't know that we ought to whet the appetite of private developers saying, hey, one of the things that we'll entertain a request from you for is we'll pay for your lighting. I don't know that we need to suggest that to anyone. So I think we just be, as a general rule, say that's not one of the things we're going to suggest that you ask us to do for you. But it doesn't seem like there's a long line of people with these requests, and that some might be meritorious and some might not. So I think we just don't necessarily need a policy. Let's take them one at a time.
then that would be fine.
Yeah.
We could just pass on this and just, well, we have it in our pocket, so
we need it sometime in the future, we can bring it forward. And just say, at this point, we don't have a policy one way or the other to do, to, you know, provide for it. We certainly don't anticipate it. We don't fund for it because we just don't know when it would ever be requested. Yeah. So,
Mr. Brady, maybe when projects come along, you can bring them before council, and then we can kind of budget on its merits.
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. Okay. We'll just take them if they come to us. Okay. So we can just pass on this policy. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks
the
for
next
the
item is also same group of gentlemen, I imagine. That's 1B. It's to hear a presentation and provide direction on proposed modifications to the speed hump policy. Gentlemen.
Yes. Again, thank you, Mayor. Council members. I'm not at the beginning. Sorry. Over the last several months, there's been a lot of conversation regarding the city's policy for speed humps and cushions in neighborhoods. There was one neighborhood in particular in Councilmember Freeman's district that there was a lot of passion, you know, around the topic on both sides, both for against the speed humps. The largest part of the conversation at that time involved the petition process and how far from the location of the proposed humps or cushions would the petition process go. So with that, the sort of traffic calming 101, the number of common requests that city staff receive are humps, which is in the upper right corner of this slide, cushions, which are still a permanent asphalt barrier, but if you can see, I don't know, the picture doesn't show it that well, but there's breaks, and so the hump is actually built in sections. And the theory here is that for emergency vehicle, primarily fire apparatus, while they wouldn't be able to avoid the hump or the cushion altogether, at least could get two tires down and not have to slow down as much as they would otherwise have to slow down for a full speed hump. We get a lot of requests for stop signs, and we spend a fair amount of time educating our citizens that the primary purpose for stop signs is not for traffic control. It's really to regulate the flow of vehicles and intersections. But, you know, this is a regular request, you know, that we get from people who are concerned either about speeding or volumes of traffic on their streets. Driver feedback signs you'll see around the city. Those, of course, are the radar signs that say what the speed limit is and then flash at you with your actual speed if you're zipping along down the street. And then, of course, striping. Won't read all this to you, but there has been some history dating back a little more than 20 years, sort of an evolution in terms of the current city speed hump policy. Most recently, the Transportation Advisory Board, which, of course, proposes or recommends things to the city council related to transportation. That group actually rejected a request to expand the neighborhood survey area to include folks who don't just live on the street but potentially drive on the street. And that's really the subject of the most recent discussion. Current process, it's a little different between cushions and humps. Humps are used on local streets, where the cushions are used more on collector streets. And the primary difference is that with humps, if it's on a local street only, do not currently have to go to the Transportation Advisory Board for consideration. If 70% of the affected owners sign a petition in favor of the installation of the humps, we move forward and do that without any further discussion, where the cushions, again, located on collectors, we complete the neighborhood survey. Again, there's a minimum 70% threshold that's required to move forward. If it's less than 70%, the proposal dies. If it's more than 70%, then we post signs throughout the neighborhood, take public comments. That's all packaged so that the Transportation Advisory Board sees sort of the numbers of for and against, regardless of whether or not they participated in the original survey. And the TAB ultimately makes a decision for or against the installation. Most recently, again, in an existing neighborhood, the threshold for 70% had been met, but a number of folks showed up at the Transportation Advisory Board with some pretty strong feelings against the proposed installation, and ultimately the TAB voted against the installation. That's the most recent example. What we are proposing, and again, this came through the discussion at Sustainability and Transportation Committee is adding a couple of steps to the process. First, if you look to the right down towards the bottom, we would propose matching the cushion and hump policy so that all requests for permanent traffic control installations would have both a public comment period and also consideration and a vote at the TAB. In addition, responding to the feedback for people who don't live directly on that street or within 300 feet of the proposed installations is a second survey, which we're calling a denial survey. So the idea is that if step four is met and 70% of the people are in favor of installing speed cushions or humps on their street, that we would go out to 600 feet and seek input from folks, and it would be the reverse. That if folks living between 300 and 600 feet of the proposed speed hump or cushion installation were opposed to the installation of the humps or cushions, that the proposal would then die. If that threshold is not met, we would still do the public comment period and again move on to the Transportation Advisory Board where any citizen can express their thoughts for or against, and TAB would then make a decision, yes or no, on the installation. Just to kind of give you a quick visual, this is the current policy in the hatched green area is the current practice where the petitions are circulated, again, on immediately adjacent to the humps or cushions, but also then extending out to 300 feet, which picks up some side streets where folks would have to or could be using the streets. The proposal then going forward, if you see, is we would maintain the original 300-foot area, but then for the denial survey, we would expand that area out to 600 feet to allow people, more people, opportunity to weigh in the process. So staff is seeking council direction on proposed modifications, again, to increase the survey area for both humps and speed cushions, as well as providing what effectively is an appeal process for folks located between 300 and 600 feet. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, gentlemen? Has this policy previously been vetted at the council committee level as well? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yes.
Mr. Freeman.
RJ and staff, I'm sure Sabina had a lot to do with this. I'm sure she wrote the majority of this, but yes, thank you for doing this. Personally, having to step out in the neighborhoods and deal with these issues have been very enlightening, so to speak. And it's been so divisive that it's been amazing to me how this process has worked. You know, it never pleases either side how this is going to turn out. And I think recently you just sent out or sending out some cards on the 24th Street area off of McKellips South. So again, I think that request has been denied, and then you're doing driver feedback signs for that, I believe so.
That's correct, Councilmember, and I should have added that. So one thing to add is that if the petition fails, we are going out and installing driver feedback signs to have some measure, you know, of at least letting people know, you know, what speed they are driving through neighborhoods. And I apologize, I sort of introduced Sabina Ellis, our city traffic engineer. Her and her staff have not only worked on the proposed update to the policy, but field many, many phone calls and emails, again, as you say, because there's passion on both sides of the issue.
Yes. And I think, you know, I'd like to see more, you know, what I've been advocating for is more of a democratic process into the decision-making for the speed hump, so I appreciate that. You know, what I don't like is neighbors, you know, pitting against each other and the anger, and here as a governmental agency, we're having to be the decision-maker, and it puts us in a tough decision, even though safety is very important for everyone. So, you know, I just support this. I know there's costs and maintenance involved. I think overall the driver feedback sign is at least a indication that we're willing to work with neighborhoods and help them slow down. And I know it's not as effective as a speed hump, but at least it shows our interaction in the neighborhood. So I appreciate you doing it, and I support this new speed hump policy.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Freeman. And I know I live in a neighborhood that find somebody who doesn't live in a neighborhood that doesn't have passion about this topic. And traffic calming devices are necessary, and we're going to continue to have. Mr. Loon and I were at a very exciting ribbon cutting yesterday morning, but it was adjacent to a neighborhood that is now going to experience a tremendous amount of traffic that they haven't previously seen. And so, you know, every week we're going to be dealing with these issues. So I don't envy the folks in your department. So I think this is a well thought through and good modification. So I endorse it. Any other comments, gentlemen?
We just need to get
Okay. See, you want a motion?
Yeah.
Okay, we get a motion and approve.
Okay. Second. Thank you, Mr. Luna. Thank you, Chris. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Okay, next item on our agenda is to... Yes. So, yeah, provide direction, and in that case, we did by making a motion. Okay, next item is to hear a presentation and provide direction on a proposed pedestrian hybrid beacon policy. We're getting all the controversial topics in one meeting. This is great.
Trying to get it all out of the way, Mayor.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, again, for the opportunity to present. So we periodically get requests for what are referred to as pedestrian hybrid beacons, a.k.a. a hawk signal. You may have heard them referred to as that. In the past, but we'd like to keep up with our acronyms, so try to keep people guessing. A pedestrian hybrid beacon is a traffic control device that would be used in lieu of a traditional traffic signal, and it is primarily used to stop vehicular traffic and allow pedestrians and bicyclists to cross a arterial roadway. So what we were trying to do is establish some criteria. Again, we had this discussion with the Sustainability and Transportation Committee. You'll see that we do have a number of existing locations kind of scattered around the city. Most recently, working with the engineering department again, we completed the installation of a hybrid beacon on University at Grand that just went active within the last month. And that was to allow connection from the north side of University, kind of encouraging people to walk or bike into our downtown. And that was a neighborhood request. And again, we brought that through the budget process, and council did approve that installation. Consideration, again, Sabina and her staff worked to develop a sort of a quantitative method for evaluating the request for a proposed installation, crash history, layout of the roadway, site visibility, but we also wanted to look at conflicts. Are there adjoining sidewalks and pathways that we would be able to connect to? You know, we don't want to send people across a roadway and then not have, you know, an ADA accessible path for people to easily get to. And also cost to supply power, because in some cases, depending on the location of the proposed installation, it could be fairly expensive to bring power to that site. So what you'll see is that we've come up with a 100-point total system, weighted more heavily in certain areas than others, and that a minimum of 60 points would be required to move forward in the consideration process for a beacon. One of the things, there's other cities that have developed policies. One of the things that I liked what our staff did is we put a little bit more focus on proximity to activity generators, is what we're referring to them, whether it be a senior center, medical facilities, schools, parks, that sort of thing, so that it's not just strictly volumes, you know, that dictate it, you know, that if we have, you know, places that people are trying to get to, obviously we'd like to get them there as safely as we can. And then, of course, posted speed limits and lanes are also part of the criteria. Staff is seeking council approval to approve this policy. What we would propose is that should a request meet the minimum threshold for installation, we would bring the request through the budget process to give council the opportunity to weigh in on that installation. We would propose setting aside funds for one installation each year, but there's always flexibility. And so if for some reason there were multiple requests, we would still propose to bring those to council for consideration along with our analysis, so you could see how the staff has evaluated the request. But ultimately, it would remain a council decision, as it should be, And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
RJ, how much do we have a kind of range of the last one and some of the others, how much they've cost?
The last one was just over, I think, $225,000. There's engineering involved. Again, one of the larger expenses, in addition to the equipment itself, is the potential for having to extend power to the area, as well as any sidewalk modifications that are required on both sides of the street. So I think 225 is probably a good working number. Could be more than that, depending on the situation. But that's based on our most recent installation on University.
And frankly, Mayor and Council, it helps, too, if we can identify these as part of a road construction project, because then it kind of, we can incorporate that into it. It makes more sense. It makes it facilitates, I think, the project a little bit easier. So as we take on some of these projects, those are some of the things we probably should look at during the time that we're scoping the project. But we've gotten these requests now over the last, how long have we been doing this? 5 years, 6 years, something like that?
Yes.
So, and I think they do provide a safety issue for pedestrians crossing some of these busy roads. And so it's a good idea, but we wanted to make sure getting kind of direction from council on a policy, and then maybe from a budgetary standpoint, if we allocate it each year, set aside about the 225 or so in our transportation budget, then we could take all the requests that came in during that year and run them through this analysis and then make a decision on which one to fund. So that's kind of where we're suggesting we look at that going forward.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman.
RJ, just curious, if you had evaluated our current Hawk signalized areas with the categories that you have here, point system, would they have passed or failed?
There is one existing signal on Brown, just west of center, that would not have met the existing criteria. And one on Sossaman as well.
I think we tried to, what we did is we looked at the 8 existing locations that we have and kind of, as we're developing this policy, seeing which ones were successful and how we could develop the scoring criteria to be able to say these are successful, these would meet the 60-point threshold. So we did look at that.
The ones on Mesa Drive, I think, have been a really good idea because we, not that we don't still have people trying to cross through the medians, but especially this time of year when it's dark, it's night, and they get used.
They do.
I think that's been, there are definitely places and locations where these can be very helpful, so.
Just a further comment. I know some of them have been driven by traffic fatalities and people not utilizing current signalized intersections and things like that. So I appreciate the category. I just wanted to, have time to think about whether the point system that you have would be reflective on the current Hawk systems we have. And, maybe they all, I'm glad to hear that they're not all would be passing the point or category process, but I like having the process here so it allows you as staff to know and evaluate each Hawk system based on its own merits. So thank you.
I was just thinking we make also recommend some of these in outside of the kind of setting up one, because we're talking about some that are connecting trails on canals that we would include as just part of that project where you have design process where you have, activity on it, where we're building out a trail or improving the trail on a canal, and you get to the other side of a busy road, we may decide that makes sense from our just design perspective, because we're going to be driving activity across that road.
That would be separate. Thank you, Mr. Brady. Yes, as we're looking at some path projects moving forward, and we're excited to be able to do that. In those instances, we typically use a traditional traffic signal, but it's certainly another tool in the toolbox. And I agree with Mr. Brady that any place where we're actually encouraging people to cross arterial streets is a good place to consider a signal installation of some kind. And that is considered as part of the design process, as Mr. Brady says.
Mr. Whitaker.
I have two questions. The existing ones that we've installed, do they keep statistics on like how often they're used and then the time frames that they're used? I think we talked about that in the SAC committee.
Councilmember Whitaker, yes. What's called actuation, that's actually someone pushing the button. We can track the number of actuations. In some cases, people don't push the button and they just cross, you know, so for those, we would not know. But for people who are actually using the system as intended, we can track the number of crossings, yes.
Okay, great. And then the other question that I had, I know one of the things we talked about in the SAC committee was the cost to run power, mm-hmm. right? So on some of the ones that I've seen where they do the solar installations with the battery packs, I think that was a conversation, but I don't remember where we went with that. Is that an option to look at those to cut down on the cost to actually have to run electricity to each of these sites?
I think if you look at, you know, the life cycle cost, and, you know, unless we're doing a really long run to get power there, a quarter mile or more, it's more cost effective in the long run to run, you know, a traditional power source to it. It's something we can look at with solar, but keeping the solar batteries, you know, we have to replace those every 3 to 5 years, and that gets expensive.
Sure, but that's an option you guys have looked at from a cost.
Customer, it is an option. Really the biggest challenge in solar, for whether it's streetlights or signals, is the batteries. You know, sure. And the battery technology, I think, is moving, but it hasn't really kept up, you know. And it's a challenge, especially in the heat. You know, the batteries are large. They're not easy to work with, and summers are pretty brutal, you know, on their life expectancy.
Sure. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, a moment ago I think we said there's going to be two different criteria for evaluating when to do these. There's the 60-point threshold for kind of mid-block crossings, but then when they're adjacent to canal paths, maybe...
We're just going to do those as part of the project.
We're just going to do those automatically.
Yeah, they won't fall into this.
Okay, so you don't need to go through the calculation if you're part of it. If the city's developing a path saying, and we're leading people to the water saying, we're going to let you drink here and cross the street, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That's great. I'm a fan. I like this, but I think it does sometimes provoke some negative reactions from drivers when they feel like they're being impeded in traffic. What is the timing of the sequence? For example, you know, a pedestrian comes, hits the button. How long is that? It seems like I've seen some where there's a fairly short period of time. It allows for about one or two pedestrians to get across the street. Then it turns to a blinking red so that drivers know, well, obviously if there's people still there, I'm not supposed to go. But if this one individual that prompted this stop has come and gone, I don't need to sit here for another 30 seconds for no good reason. What's the sequence of the lights?
So, Mayor, and I'll turn over to Mr. Guderian, but you're correct that, you know, it starts, you know, someone pushes the button, there might be a lag, the light goes to solid red, and obviously that means all stop.
Yeah.
You know? After a certain amount of time, which Eric can explain, it goes to the flashing, and you still are supposed to stop, but if the path is clear, you know, through the crosswalk, then drivers, you know, may proceed, and then it goes dark, obviously, and then traffic can just proceed as normal. It's based on the width of the street is one of the criteria, but Eric?
Yes, so Mayor, we use the pedestrian hybrid beacon, so once a person is halfway across the street or that the half of the street that you're on is clear, that you're able to proceed through and you don't have to wait the full amount of time like at a traditional signal. When the pedestrian gets that walk signal is really dependent on where the pedestrian hybrid beacon is within the city and where it falls within the other traffic signals. At some locations, you'll get that walk signal almost immediately after you hit the button that, you know, but in other locations like the one on University and Grand, where we have we're still trying to progress quite a bit of traffic on University, and there's a lot of other traffic signals, that the pedestrian hybrid beacon is still coordinated with all the other traffic signals. So as if you're a pedestrian, you still may have to wait there like at a traditional traffic signal for 30 seconds or a minute until you get it to that proper time in the sequencing that the walk signal can come up and stop the least amount of vehicles on the arterial.
So I think what you're saying is that it's depends on the
depends
particular
on the location
light, because they're so different depending on the traffic volume, and you don't have the same sequence for a small residential as opposed to a major street.
Correct.
Okay. And that makes sense. That's obviously the right thing. But I think we just need to be sensitive to not impeding traffic any longer than we need to, but at the same time, maybe encouraging the flashing red so that if there is a long list, you know, if you've got it.
So the timing whether it goes red to when it goes flashing red is typically it's red for the normal time that you would have the walk signal up. So then that's typically 7 to 10 seconds, and then it goes to flashing red during the traditional time that you have the flashing hand, the flashing don't walk period up.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Freeman.
You know, I just might add, I have two of them close to where I kind of
sure.
am. And the flashing red just says proceed if clear.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Otherwise, you're stopped if there's pedestrian there.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Okay, great. Do you need a motion on this one as well? Okay, is there a motion? Mr. Glover, thank you. And Mr. Thompson, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, gentlemen. I know a lot of work went into that, and so thanks to staff and thanks to the council committee that reviewed that prior to this.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is item two here, reports on meetings and conferences attended. Anyone? You know, I'm going to invite Mr. Luna to talk about the ribbon cutting we were at yesterday that I kind of teased people about a minute ago.
Yeah, we had a ribbon cutting at Sprouts over located on Wrecker, so just south of the 202, and there were a lot of people. There were actually people around the building twice, I think. It was amazing. It was 7 a.m. in the morning. But it's exciting. It's the flagship store of the Sprouts located in Northeast Mesa. So it was a great event to be at.
Yeah.
And we're excited for the residents that live there. They've been asking for a Sprouts, so we've given them a Sprouts.
Yeah.
So
it was... He's not exaggerating at all. People were wrapped around the building. There's a lot of enthusiasm about this grocery store. Any other reports, gentlemen? If not, item three is scheduling of future meetings and general information. Mr. Brady?
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, we'll be not having a council study session next Thursday, but we will be having the Brookings Institution. We'll be here with a panel of other local individuals and doing a presentation over the Mesa Arts Center.
Great.
We'll invite everybody to be to come and join that. You can register for that event at the Mesa Chamber website, and so we encourage everyone to come. We've got already have a very good turnout expected, so that should be an interesting discussion. And then also just a reminder, on Monday, January 15th, will be the Martin Luther King Parade, which will begin at 11 a.m.
Great. Those are both important events. So again, the Innovation District event is open to the public, but you do need to register just because there's limited seating.
Right.
Okay. And we obviously encourage everyone to participate and celebrate the MLK holiday with us on Monday. If there's nothing else, gentlemen, it's now time to convene an executive session for discussion and consultation on negotiations involving the acquisition of real property located between the Red Mountain Freeway and Lehigh Road. Is there a motion to move to executive? Thank you, Mr. Luna. Thank you, Mr. Freeman, for seconding that. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
We will now convene an executive session.